Well, good afternoon and welcome along. I'm Justin Briley, host of Unbelievable, the weekly show here on Premier Christian Radio that brings all kinds of different Christian and non-Christian perspectives together for dialogue and debate. And we've got another interesting edition of the show looking at the multiverse, a round two on that subject. We did it 2 weeks ago. I'll be introducing my guests in a moment for a brain-boggling, mind-bending edition of the show today. But if you're interested in finding more shows from the Unbelievable stable, and we do all kinds of issues, theology, philosophy, scripture, ethics, apologetics, and much, much more, go to Unbelievable's website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can download the podcast, you can find features, you can find this year's Unbelievable conference on DVD, CD, and also for digital download there, and much more besides. premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. We'll be looking at some of your feedback later on today's programme. I'll be reminding you of the Rethinking Hell conference coming up in just a week's time now. And after today's programme, you can hear me talking to Eric Metaxas. I was out in New York over the summer, and I managed to sit down with him in his radio studio there and talk about his conversion, his books, and his controversial support of Donald Trump. Listen out for that between 4 and 5 this afternoon. Right now, time to get into today's programme. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the show, we're going to be talking about the multiverse again. It's round two, and fine-tuning fights back on today's show. 2 weeks ago, we heard about the evidence for a multiverse, the idea that we are but one of a potentially infinite number of universes, and whether that deals a critical blow to the idea that our universe is fine-tuned for life, perhaps by a cosmic designer. And now in that show, both my guests, Jeff Zwierink and Skydive Phil, although they were Christian and atheist, were agreed on there being strong evidence for a multiverse and its negative implications for fine-tuning. On this follow-up edition of the show, we're going to be hearing a bit of a different take. Luke Barnes is a physicist in Australia. His new book, A Fortunate Universe, Life in a Finely Tuned Cosmos, has just been released. It's co-written with Geraint Lewis and makes a compelling case for the fine-tuning of the universe. And also deals with the question of whether the multiverse is a way of answering it. Luke himself has some critiques of multiverse theory, and he's going to be talking about that on the programme today. Our other guest is Max Andrews. He's adjunct faculty at Oklahoma Wesleyan University and a PhD research student looking at the philosophy of many worlds, fine-tuning and the multiverse. And in the course of research, he's become persuaded by the concept of the multiverse, including the quantum version. Now, that's something we didn't get to discuss last time, and we will try and look into today. He's also become increasingly sceptical of the fine-tuning of the universe as an argument for God, and that's for theological reasons. But we're going to be reflecting today on that last multiverse show. Very popular show, lots of discussion that it produced, and I'm looking forward to doing this with Luke and Max today. We'll be looking afresh at some of the common objections to the multiverse and whether fine-tuning, as I say, can fight back. So welcome along to the show, both Max here in my studio in London and Luke, who's on the line from Australia. Welcome along to the show, guys.
Hello.
Thanks for having us, yeah.
It's great to have you both on. Luke, you've got this new book out, and I like this because it's kind of doing a little bit what we try to do on Unbelievable, which is make a bit of a dialogue, because you've done it with Geraint Lewis, who's also a physicist. Just give us a brief idea of the book and how long you've been interested in the whole area of the fine-tuning of the universe.
Well, I got into this area sort of by mistake. I needed to do a public talk while I was a PhD student at Cambridge. And I always thought that this topic looked a bit fascinating, so I started to read and, got a bit carried away in the end and wrote a review article, and now I've written a book about it. So the idea of the book is, well, Geraint always wanted to write a book and then heard me do a talk on fine-tuning, and so we decided to write on this together. The book, it basically lays out, just from the scientific literature in six or seven chapters, what fine-tuning is all about from a physicist's point of view. And then the final chapter is a conversation between Geraint and I, just trying to work out what it all means.
Mm. When I was looking around for doing a second edition of the show, looking at the multiverse and looking for someone who would have a significant stuff to say about this, the thing that kept coming back to me from my inquiries was Luke Barnes is your man, basically. So you've obviously acquired a bit of a reputation, at least for being someone willing to stand up and defend fine tuning as a physicist. But also, I guess, being somewhat skeptical of multiverse theory. I mean, where do you kind of land just in general on this whole area?
Well, I have some problems with the multiverse. As a cosmologist, I'd love for it to work because that would just be more universe for me to study, right?
Yeah.
So that would be fantastic. But I think there are some hurdles it's got to jump. And I'm not entirely sure how it jumps all of those, whether it could possibly jump all of those, or whether to jump all of those, it itself needs to be fine-tuned.
Mm.
So I've got some skeptical, some questions that need to be asked about the multiverse.
It's not something you particularly put at the forefront of anything that you've written, but in terms of your own faith commitments, you are a Christian, but your co-author Geraint is not and doesn't particularly see God as being irrelevant to this discussion. Is that correct?
No, he is, quote, no kind of God botherer, end quote. So he comes down in favor of the multiverse. Whether or not you believe in God, there's another. If you believe in God, it's another question whether you think a particular piece of evidence is a good piece of evidence.
Sure.
What I really want to do in the last bit of the book is sort of lay out how it. I don't think fine tuning at least creates the sort of problem for theism that it creates for naturalism.
Mm.
That's the case that I make. But okay. There's no full blown.
So if at a minimal level, then for you, fine tuning is a significant issue for those who say there is nothing but a naturalistic universe at play here.
Yes, I think it creates problems for naturalism, and I lay out that case in the book. Mm. And looking on that sort of level, I mean, there's treating the multiverse just as a physical theory, but as a central weapon of naturalism, a central postulate of naturalism, perhaps, or I think there's some major problems there.
Okay. Well, it would be fun to maybe talk about that a bit later. But our other guest on the programme today with me in studio is Max Andrews. Max, thank you for coming down from bonnie Scotland today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. It's beautiful in London today.
Max, we've known each other for quite a while and we've been in touch over the years because you've been involved in theology and apologetics for a long time. But really, the focus of your work and research now for some time has been multiverse, many worlds, the theology and philosophy around that.
Yes.
We heard from Luke how he stumbled into this. What was your route into getting involved in this?
I think there's probably two explanations that will get us to where I am today. The first was existential reflections, the question of why am I here, where did I come from, where am I going, and of course more of the philosophical existentialist questions being asked. But it came up when I was doing a research paper on Thomas Aquinas and his definition of omniscience, and I noticed that there were problems with how it is that God comes to know certain things. Instead of his knowledge being reflective of something happening, like a logical priority, it's God knows it, therefore it happens. So there's a bit of a fatalism there. And so I took the multiverse theory to see how that could work out. And that's something that Dave Beck and I have been working with. Dave Beck's out at Liberty University. He's a mentor of mine.
Mm.
And that's really what has driven the pursuit to try to understand this a bit more, both the personal aspect and then the academic aspect.
And in the course of looking into these things, obviously at a pretty high academic level, has your mind changed and have you become more convinced in that sense that we could be part of a multiverse?
Yes. Yeah. I think that we certainly could be a part of it. I think it may be likely the case. I must admit that there is a certain element in me that wants it to be the case.
Really?
There's something quite aesthetically pleasing and beautiful and elegant about this. But I think that begs the question, which is when I notice the science of it all, I notice that I start begging the question of God's existence prior to it. And that that will come in with some of the theological reflections of it.
Yeah. Thank you very much for coming in today. Looking forward to both of your reflections on the show we had a couple of weeks ago, and to see what you both have to say in response to the evidence we heard for the multiverse in that particular show, and whether it does deliver a fatal blow to fine-tuning, at least as it's traditionally presented. So we want to hear from you too, if you're listening and you would like to give your say in anything you hear about on today's show. Why not get in touch? unbelievable@premier.org.uk. That's the email address to send your thoughts into. Don't forget, lots of people comment as well on Facebook, Twitter, and of course underneath the latest edition of the show at the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, to find today's show. Leave your comments there, send the link on to friends, subscribe to the podcast, and much more besides. And don't forget, if you're listening to this and you haven't heard that show from 2 weeks ago, the first time we did this, it was a show titled Who's Afraid of the Multiverse. Go back and listen to that, because that'll give you a real sense of the physics and the science behind it. And we're going to sort of kind of assume to some degree that you've heard that, and we can move the conversation on in today's programme. We will, of course, try to keep things, though, at a level where we can all understand and take part as well, including myself. So that's the ways to get in touch and the ways to listen back. We're talking about the multiverse, round two, fine-tuning fights back.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So let's come to you, Luke, as we get into the substance of what happened last week. You've listened to the show, you both have, where Jeff Zwierink and our atheist guest, Skydive Phil, talked about the evidence for the multiverse. And both were pretty much on the same page in terms of being fairly convinced that there's strong evidence for it. Specifically, they were addressing what's called eternal inflation and the fact that they believe that gives rise to these many universes. Just be interested in your overall take on that programme, Luke, and whether there were any things you didn't agree with in terms of the way both guests brought that across.
Well, let me start with the things I did agree with. Quickly, I agree that the multiverse should be taken seriously, and the point that Skydive Phil made, that it needs to be taken a lot more seriously by proponents of the fine-tuning argument, I think is probably a very good point to make. It certainly is not the case that it was just invented to explain away fine-tuning. Mm. I don't really think that would be a problem anyway. We just invent scientific theories to explain data, so that's fine. But, you know, there are independent reasons to think that it's an idea that we should take seriously. There are a couple of things that I would want to sort of point out. The first is there was a very quick jump from inflation to the inflationary multiverse. And I think it's worth saying that inflation, this idea that the very early universe has a very rapid expansion, and that will explain things about our universe as we observe it. For example, it'll explain why our universe is what they say is nearly spatially flat, and why it's almost perfectly homogeneous. It's the same everywhere we look. Inflation to explain that doesn't require the multiverse at all. You can just have a single universe, the single past of our universe, which inflates, and that will do all the things that inflation needs to do. It will explain all the data, all the predictions that inflation is supposed to make. So if there's a multiverse as an implication of that, it needs to be very sort of naturally tacked on to a theory of inflation. And in particular, it seems like to have a multiverse, you need to make some assumptions about the initial conditions of inflation. What was the universe like before it started inflating? Or what is the universe like as a whole when it inflates? So the question of the initial conditions of inflation is quite a difficult one, but I think that's that there needs to be a clear sort of conceptual point
I thought Phil did a great job in kind of trying to break that down for laypersons like myself, of how eternal inflation would generate a multiverse. And from what I remember, you know, his analogy of the birthday cake that keeps on growing, the idea, as I understand it, is that if the expansion, the inflation is so rapid and accelerates, the bits that break down into universes, that happens, but there's still inflation going on, producing more of these kind of pocket universes. But all of that for you is a little bit more conjectural than the actual the idea of inflation itself. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, possibly. So I heard some, I got lectures from Neil Turok on this, who's been an opponent of, well, a critiquer of inflation, who liked to draw sort of the initial conditions of inflation. So we sometimes picture how inflation works. The mathematics is similar to a ball rolling down a hill. So there's a very flat part of the hill where it's rolling slowly, and that's when inflation happens. And then the final plunge into this sort of well is where inflation ends and the sort of Big Bang as we know it begins. And Neil Turok used to sort of, how did the ball get up to the top of the hill, to the top of the flat part of the slope in the first place? He just sort of draw this giant hand coming out of the clouds and just placing the ball there. Making the point that, I mean, Bob Wald, some other scientists have pointed this out as well. It seems like those are special initial conditions. The argument from Wald's particularly good. It's if you sort of run the scenario backwards, you have a universe which is down in this lovely stable state at the bottom of the well, and then suddenly jumps back up and rolls very slowly back along this flat thing back up the hill, which looks like, if that's a very sort of unlikely special scenario, then inflation requires special initial conditions. And to simply assume that across the entire universe, multiverse, whatever, as an initial condition for inflation, at least raises some questions that oh, just inflation will solve anything.
Yeah.
Doesn't quite answer, because it seems like you need special conditions to get inflation started in the first place.
Which at one level would be another layer, in a sense of fine tuning, if that were the case.
Yes. Yeah, so if you need, yeah, special initial conditions are exactly the kind of fine tuning that inflation was supposed to solve in the first place.
Right.
This is a very much an ongoing discussion in the literature back and forth. So Bob Wald had his paper and Andre Linda replied to that. So, yeah, just to put that other part of the conversation out there.
We'll come back to some more of your thoughts on it in a moment. I'd be interested in coming to you, Max, to get your take on the program as well.
I quite enjoyed the discussion. I thought it was very helpful on both sides. And the disagreements that the two of them had, I think, were mostly minor outside of the actual inference from the data to the fine tuner. So the discussion of the data was very important and was very enlightening. And both of them made points that I could agree with, and I had no problem agreeing with it. And Phil's, first, his documentary or video was very helpful, and I would encourage listeners to go take a look at that, because the graphics are very they facilitate the imagination in a way for you to visually conceive things in a greater way. It was very nice to hear Dr. Zverin be open to the multiverse, and for him to be able to acknowledge that his position has shifted from an initial dismissal, how can I get around this, to, okay, maybe this really is the case. But one concern that I would raise is the role of whether or not this is science or this is just metaphysics. And I think that there is give and take both on the physics and the metaphysics side, the philosophy versus the science. And I think we should understand the multiverse as a prediction rather than a hypothesis or a beginning point. So in the same way that when Peter Higgs predicted his Higgs boson back in the 60s, in a there's a news network, 60 Minutes, there's a show, and in that show they interviewed Peter Higgs on it, and how did you do this?
Yeah.
And he said all he needs is paper and pencil, which is quite interesting. And so it asks the question, you know, it took us 40 years to be able to do this. And so we have to ask the question, at what point was the Higgs boson, when did it go from unscientific to scientific?
Yeah, yeah. Because that's often the case with science. Things get predicted way in advance of us having the technical capability to physically look for them. And the Higgs boson, I guess, is a case in point. I mean, on this one, though, Luke, would we ever conceivably have the ability to corroborate the prediction of a multiverse? Or is that just never going to happen?
We'd have to be wrong about a lot of physics that we think we know. So the fact that information moves at the speed of light, for example, puts a fairly firm limit on how far we can see into the universe. So if you want to confirm the multiverse by seeing other universes that have different properties, we'd have to be extremely lucky to have one of those overlap our observable universe. There have been claims along that line in Skydive Phil's agreed, excellent video. He talks to Anthony Aguirre about that, about some possibilities for that. It's not yet confirmed. It might be there, but it feels like we'd have to be very lucky. And even then, that would be in a theory that postulates a vast number, or perhaps an infinite number, of other universes. We'd have our observations would have gone from one to two, which is a start.
Yeah,
but not exactly the sort of direct verification we'd like. It would at least show us that something in what we think of the laws of physics would have to change, but.
Is it then a problem for the theory that it seems to be so resistant to ever being confirmed in the traditional ways one would confirm sort of scientific hypotheses?
I think it's cause for caution is what I'd say. I don't think it makes the theory unscientific. To be scientific is just to have an idea about how the universe works. And that idea needs to have consequences. It needs to be clear enough that we can work out, okay, what experiment should I do? We're not going to get the sort of direct confirmation of the multiverse that we want, but there are other theories where we won't get that either. They're not quite as bad as the multiverse, but at least it predicts a population of things of which we're supposed to be one of that population, and we can ask at least whether we're typical of that population. So there is a sense in which our universe is a data point that we can compare against a population of supposed universes.
Well, we'll do some comparisons later as we get into this. Max, I did mention at the outset that we only covered one particular version of multiverse theory on that show of a couple of weeks ago. One that you've particularly been interested in is what's called quantum theory of the multiverse. Now, again, you'll have to take this slowly and simply, but what's this other version then that's quite popular of a way a multiverse could in theory come about?
So I suppose it would be helpful to present it in the context of the other multiverse scenarios. So Max Tegmark at MIT gives four different versions of it. The first level of the multiverse being infinite space, the second being these bubble universes, these inflationary models. The third is the quantum version. And with the quantum version, it has an umbrella categorical inclusion of inflationary scenarios. So it's not that they are mutually exclusive. There is overlap between the two. You can trace these types of models back to the pre-Socratics, but in the more sophisticated, scientifically sound versions of today, you can be traced back to Hugh Everett back in 1956, his PhD thesis out at Princeton. And it comes out of a solution to the measurement problem in physics. And the measurement problem is trying to, I'm sure Luke could explain this much better, but it comes out to how it is that we can know the state of quantum interactions.
And quantum particles and so on being the very tiniest thing we can think of as far as physics is concerned.
Yeah, think element photons, electrons.
Yeah.
And one of the solutions is superpositions. Think of Schrodinger's cat. You know, when you close the box, is the cat dead or alive? And so that's one of the solutions. And so you've got one problem to begin with on that scenario of, well, what is a superposition? How can this be? How can a cat be both dead and alive and exist in these seemingly contradictory states? And Everett's solution removes the superposition aspect out of the equation. So we don't have to consider both dead and alive cats. Well, it's not either or. It's not dead or alive. It is both dead and alive.
Mm-hmm.
And the uncertainty that comes in with these measurements about whether either or, dead or alive, the uncertainty inevitably becomes an uncertainty of our universe in the greater quantum version of the multiverse.
Okay, I'm not going to say I followed all of that, but Luke, do you want to have a stab as well to boil it down to what the quantum version of the multiverse is?
Yeah, it helps to have a couple of people have a go at quantum mechanics. It really does. The basic picture in quantum mechanics, when we look at, so Schrödinger's cat is this diabolical device where after an hour, quantum mechanics says that, what quantum mechanics says about the system is written down as cat alive plus cat dead. Now, what you do with that is now how you interpret quantum mechanics. So what the sort of older interpretation said was, okay, when you open the box and measure the cat, those two possibilities will collapse into one or the other. But that's the problem with that is the measurement problem. Exactly what is a measurement? When you measure the cat, what does that mean? It seems like I then interact with the cat in the box, and now what we should say is the whole system is cat is alive and Luke sees alive cat, plus cat is dead and Luke sees dead cat. But I've still got these two things adding together, but I don't know what to do with them, whereas all our observations only see one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the strange thing. So what Everett said was, okay, what happens when you open the box is that these two possibilities stop interacting with each other. They stop. So what you have in quantum mechanics is that these separate possibilities seem to interact with each other. That's where all the quantum weirdness comes in. But at some point they don't, and that's what we think of as a measurement. What Everett says was, no, they at some point the possibilities stop interacting with each other, but they're still there. And so what you can do is treat them as if they've just literally two separate universes. There's a sort of dead cat and a live cat just on top of each other, but they're not interacting with each other anymore.
Right.
And when you open the box, the uncertainty comes as to whether you find yourself in the branch. You shouldn't really call it another world. It's just a part of our world that's not interacting with everything else. You'll either join one or the other, and that's where the uncertainty comes from.
Okay, so
I'm not sure if that helps.
I mean, there are going to be some people going on, what's this got to do with cats in boxes? But if you want a bit of a primer, just Google Schrödinger's cat and you'll get a sense of where this analogy is coming from. But the point being, as soon as you open the box on Schrödinger's cat, two universes, let's say, could begin to exist, one in which the cat is alive and one in which the cat is dead, because both those possibilities were possible. And in some sense, on this theory, all possibilities will manifest themselves at every moment that anything happens physically, there's going to be different branches coming off. Is that kind of along the right lines?
Well, I'd like to make a qualifying note here. There's two different ways we can understand the differences between these measurements. There's this branching structure that we're referring to. Luke was using the reference of, you know, they don't interact anymore. And if you try to visualize, a branching tree, we often have that in mind of these branching worlds. But these branching worlds are becoming much more unpopular in the literature for the many worlds interpretation of Everett. Mm. And rather, many of the philosophers and physicists are adopting a divergent version. So instead of the branching tree structure, just think of the landscape the picture in your mind of just telephone poles, just single worlds of just one line that don't interact with other ones. So with these other worlds or these other universes. And I want to be very careful about worlds versus universes.
Yeah. We may have to leave it there because we're running out of time in this first part. In fact, we're well over time. The picture I've got in my head is the Hollywood version of this, which is Gwyneth Paltrow in Sliding Doors, in which she catches the train in one universe and doesn't in another, and her life goes very differently because of it. But whether that amounts to anything like whatever it imagined, who knows? But we're going to continue talking about the multiverse in the next section of today's programme. Round two, looking at this fascinating issue of whether we could be one among many universes and whether that poses a problem for the idea of fine-tuning. We're hearing a slightly more sceptical take on the issue of fine-tuning and, well, certainly on the issue of the multiverse from Luke Barnes. And Max Andrews is a PhD student looking into the whole issue of the multiverse and the philosophy of it. We'll be back in a short moment's time with part two of today's Unbelievable. 40 years ago, four teenagers met in a kitchen in Dublin and decided to form a band. Since then, U2 have conquered the rock world and never been afraid to sing about God while doing so. In the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine, we chart their four-decade spiritual journey and the impact they've had on the global church. Plus, we talk to Eric Metaxas on why he's backing Trump. We explore the rise of the true crime documentary and find new ways to pray. All that plus much more. Make sure you pick up a free sample copy at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to today's programme. We're talking about the multiverse. For a second time, 2 weeks ago, we heard about the evidence for a multiverse, the idea that we're but one of a potentially infinite number of universes, and whether that deals a critical blow to the idea that our universe is fine-tuned for life by a cosmic designer. If you'd like to get in touch about anything you hear on today's show, do encourage you to email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. We'll be hearing some of your feedback to recent shows a little bit later on the programme. You can find Unbelievable, of course, on Facebook and Twitter at UnbelievableJB and facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. All those links, today's programme, the podcast and much more available from the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Lots of people check in there every week and leave comments and things like that. There's also loads of resources. You can find this year's conference on DVD and CD, as well as the digital download option as well. All the links and more available, as well as the show that we did that sparked this second round, Who's Afraid of the Multiverse, with Jeff Zwierink and Skydive Phil. That'll be on the episodes there if you want to get hold of it. A little later on today on Premier Christian Radio, you can hear The Profile. Another Christian guest talks about their life and faith journey. That's between 4 and 5 this afternoon. I'll also be showing you what's coming up on the next edition of Unbelievable a little later on today's programme. My two guests today are Luke Barnes and Max Andrews. Luke is a physicist in Australia. His new book, A Fortunate Universe, Life in a Finely Tuned Cosmos, is co-written with Geraint Lewis, makes a compelling case for the fine-tuning of the universe, for allowing life to exist. There could have been all kinds of other versions of universes that theoretically could have been produced. Why our universe in particular? Luke's addressing the whole issue of whether multiverse theory is an appropriate answer to the issue of this apparent fine-tuning of our universe. Could it be that we just happen to drop out of the mix of many, many universes, all with different initial conditions and settings and so on? Max Andrews is a research student looking at the philosophy of many worlds, fine-tuning, and the multiverse. He's a Christian as well, but he's become pretty persuaded of the concept of the multiverse in the course of his study, both the quantum version and other versions, and increasingly sceptical, actually, of the fine-tuning of the universe as an argument for God. A lot of that to do with theological reasons, and we'll get to that as well in the course of the show. If you want to check out Luke's blog, letterstonature.wordpress.com is where he blogs quite often. Max has a blog at sententious.org. But today we're really kind of coming back to this issue of the multiverse, gentlemen. And Luke, often this thing that's coined a Boltzmann brain is often used as evidence against the idea that we are part of a multiverse. Let's take it right back, though, and if you could explain firstly why some people say this so-called Boltzmann brain issue does represent a problem for the multiverse, and secondly what your take is on all this, and whether it does provide some kind of evidence against the multiverse.
Right, so what we're doing here is treating the multiverse like any other scientific theory which makes predictions. The thing that the multiverse predicts is a population of universes, each with their own properties. So then we ask, are we in our universe typical of the observers that you would find in a given multiverse? Now, the reason it's called the Boltzmann brain problem is because of Ludwig Boltzmann, who was a great physicist in the 1800s, who had this idea about the sort of the first multiverse. Why, if the universe obeys the second law of thermodynamics, if things go from orderly to disorderly states, why are we now in a state that's still got some order in it? And his idea was, maybe the universe as a whole is in a disorderly state, but just by chance, because the second law is a stochastic thing rather than a definite unexceptional thing without any exceptions. Maybe every now and then a bit of order pops up in the universe, and if you want to observe the universe, you better have some order around you, because living things almost by definition require some sort of order.
Mm.
And so the problem with that was raised by Eddington in the 1930s, who said, okay, what's this? Let's get your clipboard out and let's do a survey around Boltzmann's multiverse. And whenever you find someone who's capable of answering a question, ask them how big their universe is. How big is the region of order around them amidst this multiverse of chaos? And what Eddington argued quite convincingly was that because you're relying on a chance fluctuation to get you order, you'll only get as much as you need and no more.
Mm.
If each bit of order is sort of a, you know, you have to wait a squazillion years to get it, it's very unlikely you'll get more than you need. And so everyone fills out that questionnaire. Almost everyone says, you know, I've got, you know, the space I need and not much more. Whereas what we observe around us is a universe that's orderly as far as the telescope can see.
Mm.
So if we apply that to the modern multiverse, what we need to do is say, okay, there are chance, you know, fluctuations that could create an observer. And if you need the Boltzmann brain's a lovely sort of visceral image of this single brain just popping into existence somewhere in the universe. What you need to do with your theory, to take your theory seriously, is to say, all right, what fraction of the observers or observations will be of someone like us who observes a sort of coherent, large, orderly universe around them, and what fraction will be not what we see, what will be observations that are just of a chaos that's one brain width across and lasts about 10 seconds. And it's not, the problem is not that, you know, we might be in the Matrix, we might be a brain in a vat, we might be a Boltzmann brain and we'll never know. It's not that sort of skeptical problem, although okay, if you want to think about that, that's fine.
Uh-huh.
The problem is really just straightforward. The theory makes a prediction. If your multiverse theory says that most observers will be these Boltzmann brains, then it's made a wrong prediction.
Okay, so if I can try and kind of put that in language for me as well, the idea being the level of order and the size of the universe we inhabit or appear to inhabit would be highly unusual in terms of what you would a multiverse would normally produce in terms of something able to observe itself, and the normal thing would be a brain popping into existence briefly, seeing around itself a small disordered universe and probably popping out of existence again, and you'd be much more likely, if you're going to observe a universe, to see that than what we see is kind of how it boils down. Am I kind of getting there with that?
Well, that's the case for Boltzmann's multiverse. It's an open question whether that same problem affects, say, eternal inflation or, you know, any other sort of modern multiverse.
Right. And but for you, there is still an issue that we wouldn't expect to see what we see if the modern multiverse is a goer. Is that correct?
Yeah, so this is the argument that's been made by Roger Penrose. I think the argument against Boltzmann's multiverse still works quite well. I mean, it's a different scenario, but just on entropy grounds, on grounds. So entropy is a quantity in physics which sort of measures the amount of order in a very specific way. And so on very general grounds, I think you can say if we are just a fluctuation out of a highly disordered state, we wouldn't see as much order as we see. And Penrose fairly straightforwardly applies that to the multiverse as well. Now, there are ways of getting around that, but I'd argue that all they do is just say that, just assume that the early universe, the state that we evolved from, is a highly ordered state to start with, which so either you have the Boltzmann brain problem or you're making a very specific assumption about the initial conditions of the universe.
One of the issues that Phil raised on that program a couple of weeks ago was that, as far as he's concerned, the so-called Boltzmann brain is also a problem for a single universe, more so than a multiverse. Because I think he says that Sean Carroll, for instance, says that if an ordinary universe can have a Boltzmann brain problem if there is a cosmological constant that you've got, I guess, enough space that you will find a fluctuation somewhere that will produce a Boltzmann brain as well. Do you kind of follow that or not convinced on that?
Yeah, he's right. So he's right that our universe could have a Boltzmann brain problem into its future, but we don't just leave it at that. What we say then is, okay, what could solve that problem? And so one of the things that Sean has presented, we're at a conference together and he was on before me presenting this exact solution, is that maybe the conditions in the way off in the future of the universe, where they'll just be, because of the expansion, just almost complete vacuum, maybe you won't actually get Boltzmann brains fluctuating into existence there. But the Boltzmann brain problem in our universe is still a problem. We try to fix it. And the question is, when we find the solution that will fix it, will it solve the multiverse's Boltzmann brain problem? And I don't think it will, just be on the same sort of general order and disorder grounds. Yeah. I mean, we can think of ways of solving the problem in our universe. Sean's presented one. It could be that our universe in the future undergoes some sort of transition, physical transition, so that it doesn't end up creating those extra Boltzmann brains. Those sorts of solutions, I don't think, although, you know, I'm open to be convinced, but I think they're very specific solutions. Yeah. They won't save the multiverse from Boltzmann brains.
So in summary, at present, on the current state of things, you find that this Boltzmann brain issue still presents a kind of a disconfirmation of the multiverse theory, because we are evidently not Boltzmann brains ourselves. And if we were observing anything, we should be, that would be what we would most obviously be in a multiverse scenario.
I think so. Well, let me just say a bit more, you know, with a bit more nuance. I think there's a problem here. One of the problems with inflation is that, even George F. Stathews described it as a cartoon theory. It's there are so many versions of it, and they're all so simplistic because we don't know what the thing is that causes inflation. There's a article called the Encyclopedia Inflationaris, which lists whatever 100 or so models, and there's another 200 in another paper. So we have these sort of cartoon models there's on general grounds you have this order and disorder argument, but for a specific multiverse, it's hard to know because a lot of them are just sort of toy models because we don't really know the physics. In particular, if the context of the discussion is naturalism versus theism, then the real argument here is not really the scientific one that worries cosmologists. It's a comparison between a theistic single universe and a naturalistic multiverse, just for the moment, considering those two options. So the fact that a naturalistic universe might also have a Boltzmann brain problem is neither here nor there. You're going to have a hard time convincing the average theist that God is likely to make a universe in which most observers have completely morally meaningless lives of about 3 seconds of chaos.
Sure.
I don't think the theist is going to keep him up at night if he thinks that the fine-tuning argument works.
It's high-level stuff, and thank you for trying to boil it down in that way, Luke. Let's shift the conversation back towards Max again, because what we haven't really talked about much at all at this point is fine-tuning itself, and that, of course, is actually where the major part of Luke's book is concerned. And I'm hoping to bring you back again, Luke, perhaps for a conversation with someone like Sean Carroll to sort of really go through some of the other stuff in your book, because in a sense, the multiverse is very much something that you discuss right at the end. But Max, this is all somewhat relevant for you, though, the fine-tuning issue, because I guess in the past you've sort of seen fine-tuning as having some pretty strong credentials for being an argument for the existence of God. We live in this apparently fine-tuned universe. It's very hard to explain that by anything other than design, unless, you know, a multiverse scenario could be true. But quite apart from the multiverse scenario, you've started to develop issues, theological issues, with using fine-tuning as an argument for God's existence. Do you want to kind of briefly sketch that out?
I suppose when we look at the fine-tuning argument, we're asking what is the best explanation for the data, and the options will boil down to whether it's chance, by necessity of some form or another, or design. And when detecting design, you can detect it by agency as intentional action. you know, the purpose there. And also agency as initiation, that it's contingent. You know, in the same way that an agent is able to initiate and cease a series of cause and effect. And a lot of times, a lot of the focus for the multiverse explanations by naturalistic defenders typically appeal to chance elements. And that just, to me, that's just quite unconvincing. There's not very good power to it. Mm. It may be able to explain a lot of the data, but its power of explaining, I would consider very weak. And so I started looking at some of the necessity options, and it seems that Everett offers an explanation here. And I think it is a good competing explanation for the data.
And by necessity for this, that means that there's some underlying principle, let's say, which explains why everything seems so incredibly fine-tuned to allow life to exist. That there's something underlying the physical laws that means they have to take these particular values.
Yeah, and when going through the measurement problem, they come out with what are called projectors, describing the different states that it might be, whether it be dead or alive. And so you have to ask the question, you have to ask identity claims, you know, are these the same cat? Well, they're numerically different in the sense that, no, one cat is not the other. But they're qualitatively similar. They are duplicates, I think would be an appropriate word. And so this gives that divergent structure in the sense that there are complete universes, many of which have segments that are qualitatively similar or identical to one another, but they don't have any parts in common, each located in a distinct space-time. So this view can interpret much of our ordinary uncertainty of contingent facts, such as dead or alive, or the position of chairs in a room. The contingency can be explained by this, in the sense that the fundamental reality that this universal wave function that determines these different states, there is no contingency there.
Now, okay, we're going to have to explain some terms. First of all, simply, what do you mean by things being contingent?
They owe their existence to something else. It's dependent on something.
Right.
I suppose think about it in the terms of color. Mm. At the fundamental level of reality, there is no color until you get to this larger perspective. And so these attempts this formulation, the formalism of Everett's quantum mechanics, the diverging structure of these worlds also account for contingency and necessity. And so it is by necessity that these worlds appear the way they are.
I think I'm following. I mean, this is stretching my brain. So if you're listening and you're not following, this is a tough one because you're obviously trying to boil down, you know, a whole PhD thesis here into simple language.
Let's return back to these inflationary scenarios then. Yeah. So we understand the whole canvas of what we're talking about, the data being explained. So let's go back to the data. Mm. What are we trying to explain? And so we can go through the six numbers and go through all of these examples of local fine-tuning and whatnot. But these will be instantiated, or these will obtain in many of these different worlds by necessity. Hmm. And so the explanation that this naturalistic, the Everettian will appeal to, their explanation can explain the data. And so it goes back to whether or not you have to go back and interpret and argue why Everett's interpretations are wrong. I think there's a lot of good reasons for why his explanations may be good, but it changes it takes us off course to defend fine-tuning.
Okay, so just join the dots for me a bit here then. Why, I think I'm following you, but why does this make God, I think your issue is that God himself becomes contingent at some level if you're using God as an if you're using fine-tuning as an argument for a designer God.
Okay, so let's argue the inflationary scenarios, and the data that we're trying to explain is at least this one universe that we're observing and possibly these other bubble universes. And the inference from being able to detect design to a designer or fine tuner, how much of the data can that actually explain? How can it explain these other universes that are causally distinct from one another, that do not interact, that don't have any parts in common? And I think that might be a bit ad hoc to try to stretch it that way. Now, the Evretian can pander to the fine-tuning argument. They can completely concede everything, saying, yes, it's valid, it's sound. I think the inference from design to a designer is a legitimate one. But the fine-tuner for the Evretian is a contingent fine-tuner, in the sense that it is this fine-tuner emerges from these other universes or scenarios. And so Max Tegmark goes on to explain how, well, he actually hasn't explained too much on it, which is part of the thesis, as far as, well, can a scientific theology be developed here? Can there be a God? And he concedes, yes, there can be a God,
but
to explain
this. But it's a God that's part of the universe rather than the creator.
Correct.
Of the universe.
So in a sense, the Evretian can completely accept the fine-tuning argument. And then we've got...
I guess my immediate reaction, and not having admittedly followed all of the detail there, but that couldn't the theist just say, well, God's the author of the whole show. He stands outside of... He created the particle physics and the quantum mechanics and everything else that forms these Evretian universes.
I think that is what the theist will say, but what is motivating us to be able... Are we arriving at that conclusion from the data we're trying to explain?
Right, yes.
Or are we importing that for other reasons?
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I don't know, Luke, how much of this you've kind of interacted with yourself. This is obviously going down, as you would expect from Max's PhD, a more philosophical route in terms of looking at some of the issues around fine-tuning. Do you kind of follow any of these particular arguments and difficulties with fine-tuning?
Yeah, so let me say a few things about that. I think the main one is the Evretian worlds... What they explore are the different possibilities within quantum mechanics. So, for example, if you had an Evretian game of chess, it would sort of simultaneously play out every game of chess.
Yeah.
But it would not turn the chess into checkers.
Mm-hmm.
So within quantum mechanics, you have a set, you have the sort of the, well, it's called the Lagrangian, but I can't think of the, you have the sort of the equivalent of the rules of chess there that's governing the whole system. And the fine tuning that we look at is of the constants, is the parameters in that law. So for example, if the law that's governing you is the one that governs electrons, then there's a number in there that tells you how much charge electrons have. Now, take that, put it in any scenario you like, let Everett make all the worlds they like. It'll never change the fine-tuning constant. It won't. It will change the arrangements of the electrons and the photons and all of that. But Everett won't, unless you put in a higher level physics. You have to go back and change the deeper law itself if you want Everett to actually change these constants. You have to make them not constants anymore. You have to have them be not a law like the chess laws, but sort of a piece on the board that when you move it around to this way, now you've got this particular value of a constant. So what I'm disagreeing with Max is that if we just let Everett, you know, go bananas on our laws of nature, that we'll explain the fine tuning, whereas it won't touch the constants unless you push it up to a higher level. You have to suppose that there is this super law under that law. What we think of as constants are just possibilities within the theory, and then Everett can go and find those possibilities. Then it's some super game where when the pieces do something, it's checkers. When they do something else, it's chess. And then if you do every law, you'll do that. So that's my disagreement with Max.
I feel like I'm just repeating myself, but this is complex stuff, and I'm not going to expect everyone to necessarily follow every aspect of this. I think Max wants to come back, which we'll do in a moment. We'll go to a quick break. Just briefly before we go to the break, Luke, generally, this quantum view of the multiverse, this Everettian view and so on, do you kind of give it any credence? Do you prefer the eternal inflation kind of way of getting to the multiverse over this one?
The Everett view, I think, has had some very poor defenders, so it sounds more bonkers than it is. Now, it's pretty bonkers, but actually the more I look into it, the more sort of sense that it makes. And certainly the problem with quantum mechanics is that it's weird, and there's no sort of nice, there's no not weird way of looking at it.
You have to keep talking about cats and boxes to get it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the cats and boxes are weird, so how you interpret that's always going to be weird. It makes some sense to me. I'm not totally sold on it. And like I said, I don't see an automatic solution to fine-tuning in it.
Okay, we're going to take a break, and we'll be back in a moment's time to continue to boggle your brain this afternoon on fine-tuning and the multiverse. Round two, where we're kind of digging even deeper into the philosophy and issues around the multiverse. What would it mean if we lived in just one of many universes? Would there be any way of proving that? And what does it do to fine-tuning the idea that we live in a universe that was set up, it would appear, to allow life to develop in it? And my guest today, Max Andrews, who's a PhD research student looking at the philosophy of the multiverse, and he's also adjunct faculty at Oklahoma Wesleyan University. And also my other guest, Luke Barnes, author of A Fortunate Universe, Life in a Finely Tuned Cosmos, written with Geraint Lewis, going to be continuing and finishing off this conversation in just a moment's time.
In July 2016, Unbelievable, the conference took place in London, a day for any Christian who struggles to share their faith with others.
I'm Justin Brierley, and I hosted a fantastic day of inspirational sessions with J. John, Gary Habermas, Beth Grove, and many others.
Now you've got the chance to watch and listen to over 12 hours of this empowering conference,
featuring evangelism, apologetics, and the resurrection.
Get your DVD at premier.org.uk/shop and become a confident evangelist today.
Welcome back to the final part of Unbelievable this Saturday afternoon, brought to you in association with Premier Christianity Magazine. You can get hold of the latest edition of the mag, our special U2 at 40 feature on the front cover, but loads of interesting stuff inside, including an interview with Eric Metaxas. I was out in New York recently, spoke to him. He's a radio host himself, broadcasting out of New York, and he's written a number of books, perhaps best known for his biography of Bonhoeffer. Interestingly, has somewhat controversially come out in support of Donald Trump, at least against Hillary. And you can read that in the latest edition of the mag, a free sample available at premierchristianity.com/freesample. He'll be my guest, though, on The Profile this afternoon between 4 and 4:30 today. So you can hear him talking about those issues with me a little later on today. Next week on the programme, we're going to be looking at the issue of the history of Christianity and whether it gave us, in a sense, the values of human rights, human freedom, equality, and so on. That's the view of historian Tom Holland. He published a fascinating article about why he changed his mind about Christianity. He's going to be joining me on the programme next week to talk about that. In the company also of Larry Hurtado, who's a New Testament scholar and has written a book recently called Destroyer of the Gods, talking about the unique nature of Christianity in the first century. Should be a really fascinating discussion. Same time next week. Hope you can join me for that. Don't forget that if you're also interested in theological issues, you might want to come along to the Rethinking Hell conference happening on Friday the 7th and Saturday the 8th of October in London. I'll be hosting the Saturday of the conference. And really, for anyone who's interested in exploring the ideas around conditional immortality, annihilationism, as a popular view of the fate of those who don't accept Christ. And speakers include Roger Forster, David Instone Brewer, Chris Date. If you want more info, rethink. RethinkingHellConference.com. Just a week away, so do make sure to book in for that if you want to go along. RethinkingHellConference.com. Also, for those who are interested, there is, of course, a meeting of the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group. That's a monthly meeting of Unbelievable listeners, both atheist, agnostic, Christian, and so on, happening at the William the Fourth Pub, its usual place in Seven Shepherdess Walk, on Monday, the 10th of October. The Great Resurrection Debate this time. They'll be talking about the resurrection, discussing that in an informal capacity. You might want to get along there. Check out their page at the meetup.com website for the Great Resurrection Debate coming up. Okay, time to get back into the final part of today's show.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
So on the final part of this discussion, we're talking about the multiverse. And actually, during the break, there was a fantastic discussion going on between Max, the philosopher, and Luke, the scientist, of which I only understood about 5%. But arguing about the fundamental nature of Everettian worlds and whether it should be understood in this way or that way. I'm not going to attempt to get you to reproduce what you just discussed in the break there, gentlemen. But my guests are Luke Barnes and Max Andrews. This is a bit of a mind-bending, brain-boggling show for you on the multiverse as we approach the issue again of whether we do live in one of many universes. Could that be an explanation for the apparent fine-tuning of the universe we find ourselves in? Luke Barnes, physicist in Australia, his new book, A Fortunate Universe, Life in a Finely Tuned Cosmos, makes the case for fine-tuning and addresses issues around whether a multiverse could explain it. He's overall somewhat sceptical of multiverse theory, as you've heard on today's show. And Max Andrews, whose PhD research has been looking at the philosophy of many worlds, fine-tuning the quantum theory of the multiverse and so on. Again, if you want to look into some of this stuff, their blogs are sententious.org, that's for Max, and letterstonature.wordpress.com for Luke Barnes' blog. Gents, it's been one of those shows which I love doing, but which leaves me scratching my head, because you guys obviously are coming at this from a, you know, a place where you've really looked into these issues, and I'm sure some people will have struggled to keep up, not least myself. But let's just try and recap somewhat on the general field that we've looked at here. Luke, starting with you. So you've written a book on the fine-tuning of the universe, and I'd love to have you back on to really get into fine-tuning, and perhaps we can do that with someone like Sean Carroll in due course. But you obviously feel it's important enough to write a whole book on that. I'm getting the sense, as much as you're keen to understand and interact on the issue of the multiverse, it's certainly not cut it dead or anything, the idea of a multiverse for you at this point. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. It's still very much a live option. What I hope I've laid out today are sort of the hurdles that it has to jump. And I think it would be amazing if there's a theory out there that can jump those hurdles, then that would be one of the greatest cosmological theories we've ever seen.
And just briefly, the theories, the hurdles that you outlined today were A, that there's a bit of a leap for you from inflationary theory to the multiverse, something we can't detect, you know, under normal conditions. And obviously this question of what kind of observer we would expect in such a multiverse, and the one we do observe, us, just doesn't seem to jive with what you would probably expect in this kind of a scenario. Am I kind of more or less summarizing the two main concerns you've outlined?
Yeah, that's basically it. So in particular, this Boltzmann brain problem is a standard way of trying to work out whether a theory works, and if only very special multiverses can make most of their observers look like us rather than these Boltzmann brains, then it looks like the multiverse is fine-tuned in exactly the same way. So those are the sorts of worries that, those sorts of hurdles that the multiverse has to jump.
And I think I've also heard you saying essentially that even if we go down a multiverse route, that doesn't necessarily, that's not necessarily a great thing for the atheist and the naturalist. There's issues there as well, as far as you're concerned.
It might be fine-tuned anyway, so that's a problem. Mm. And I mean, certainly it's not an either or. It's not if there is a multiverse, then it must be naturalistic. There's still a discussion to be had, which I think Jeff covered last time, about what sort of multiverse tells us about the larger, you know, possible things beyond space and time themselves.
And obviously, where you diverge significantly from your co-author of the book, Geraint, is that you think design is still an option on the table as far as fine-tuning is concerned.
Yes, I do. I think you have to have a very big picture of God, though. If you have a picture of God as a sort of cosmic fairy just fluttering around in the universe trying to find a job, then that's, it's not going to be much help at all. But if you think of God as being a necessary being who is, you know, perfectly good, if you have a sort of perfect being, the big picture of God that you find in Christianity and the major monotheisms, then I think you can, the fine tuning is not a problem for you in the way that it should be at least something uncomfortable for the naturalist.
Thank you so much for being with us on the show today, Luke, and look forward to maybe bringing you back at some point in the not too distant future. I mean, in another universe, we had a show where you were defending a completely different set of propositions on a show called Believable or something, but in any case, it's been fun having you on this version of this show in this universe. Max, thank you as well for coming in. Max, I'm not going to claim that I understood everything that you said today, because you've thought through these things, and obviously these are huge issues that you're trying to distill into ways that are understandable. But overall, if I could try and distill your position, you're open and sympathetic to the idea we do live in a multiverse, and you've become less inclined towards traditional apologetic arguments for God around the fine tuning of the universe because A, the multiverse could explain that, and B, because you find that it rather limits the nature of God as far as you're able to see because of these concerns that it kind of turns God into a consequence himself of the natural universe.
Correct. I think in summation, the structure of these of Everett here is able to account for these contingencies and variations, since there's no interactions. You know, perhaps there are variations, and there are many philosophers who would consider that yes, these fundamental laws can vary; these six numbers can change. And one thing that the problem is highlighted with what Luke just said about our picture of God, so let's step back and ask ourselves, what's the motivation here? So fine-tuning arguments are most often used in cumulative case apologetics, evidential apologetics.
Yeah.
And we go from the point of fine-tuning arguments is to get us to a very intelligent being. And then we'll take the cosmological argument and say, well, we've got a very powerful being. And moral argument, we've got a morally perfect or holy being. And I think if we start with a picture of God, we just start begging the question.
Right.
So I think if we start with just Everett, they can explain, okay, yeah, there is a fine tuner. If they want to concede it, they can say, yes, there is a fine tuner who is contingent, but unless you want to say that God is a contingent being, then I think there are problems with that. But I don't think we can use that in a cumulative case, because the contingency versus necessity aspect, that has to be uniform across each argument.
I mean, in the end, then, are you tempted to sort of ditch kind of natural theology kind of arguments for God, the idea that you can, from nature, deduce that there is a creator God, and kind of just say, no, we just have to more approach God by revelation, you know, direct revelation.
It has made me think if the Calvinists have been right about this, if the presuppositional approach is correct. But I think it comes down to the issue of contingency. I don't think. And that would be the difference between these Everettian scenarios. I think that's how the Christian or the theist could respond to this, in the sense that, no, it's God who is able to explain all these. But I'm going to need God earlier in my explanation to try to explain this.
Yeah.
So I think a theistic inference can be made rather than just simply a designer or a fine-tuner inference.
Okay, it's been fascinating stuff. Thank you, Max. And I hope that in some way an accessible form of your final PhD will be made available for people to be able to trace the work that you've been undertaking. But really happy to have had you on. Thank you for coming in. Thank you for being
pleasure.
On the line as well, Luke. And if you want to continue your argument, your discussion, which I will, again, probably only follow a small part of after the show, you're welcome to do so. But for the moment, we'll say goodbye and thank you both very much for being on this second round looking at the multiverse today on Unbelievable.
Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, as ever, if you'd like to get in touch about what you heard today, you can email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can tweet or Facebook your response as well, facebook.com/unbelievablejb, to like the Facebook page and see what I post there on a daily basis, and twitter.com/unbelievablejb or @unbelievablejb for my handle if you want to get in touch with me that way. It'd be lovely to hear from you. I'm going to be reading out some responses to the first Multiverse show, and then I'm sure in due course we'll have some more responses to this show in a moment's time, and also some thoughts again on the Derren Brown interviews that took place a few weeks ago now. We'll see what you had to say maybe next week to last week's programme on Soren Kierkegaard, which was well received. Lots of people appreciated the kind of just changing up the format a bit and just talking about an individual, what he contributed to theology in the course of his life. This was fun from Ben Trigg, who got in touch with a poem who it seems quite appropriate to the sort of subjects we've been discussing recently. He says, "Isn't it quite something that something came from nothing, that nothing could do something to make it all appear? But let me tell you something, nothing can do nothing. We all have come from something. Ain't that a quaint idea? So lay the heavy burden of proof upon the person who in some strange delirium holds this hypothesis, that everything existent proceeds from that which isn't, that nothing in its wisdom made such a world as this." I thought that was rather good, Ben. Thank you very much. The multiverse. So in round one, when we had Jeff Zwierink, our Christian, and our atheist Skydive Phil, both essentially sharing a lot in common as regards the evidence for the inflationary view of the multiverse. I had a very interesting email back from Josh Parikh. He's been a former guest on this show. He's a young Christian philosopher, very bright young apologist, and he wanted to offer a number of points that he found interesting about that show. And I sent it on to both Jeff and Phil, and wanted to give them a chance to respond to him as well. So Phil's emailed me back with his thoughts as well on the back of that. So here's these two emails. Bear with me. They're fairly detailed, so I'll run through them. So Josh very much sort of putting some of the problems that exist when it comes to a multiverse view that sort of in order to solve the fine-tuning issue. Says, firstly, there are severe probabilistic issues with using fine-tuning to confirm the multiverse. Coming back to the dice, if you don't know whether there are many rolls or one roll and you roll a double six, the specific fact that this roll is a double six does not confirm a many rolls hypothesis, because this more specific fact compared to some roll is a double six is equally likely on a many rolls hypothesis versus a single roll hypothesis. This extends to the multiverse. The specific fact that this universe is fine-tuned for life is equally likely on a single universe versus a multiple universe hypothesis. As other universes are unobservable, this is the most specific fact we can know and cannot confirm the multiverse. Roger White advances this in what is known as the inverse gambler's fallacy. Second objection he would make to the multiverse, Boltzmann brains were discussed, and interestingly it was argued that the multiverse makes it easier to solve this problem. It really depends on the type of Boltzmann brain. One type is a quantum fluctuation, and I assume fallibly that Guth and Phil talk about this, but there's also a Boltzmann brain which results from thermal fluctuations of energy, and as Robin Collins has shown in a recent paper, these Boltzmann brains occur in every universe of a multiverse, including non-fine-tuned ones, meaning that they vastly dominate embodied agents, and that means that either the multiverse makes false predictions about our universe, we should be Boltzmann brains and we aren't, or we have an undercutting defeater for everything we believe. Amusingly, William Lane Craig, who was bashed by Phil, advanced this against notable cosmologist Sean Carroll, and Carroll didn't even understand the objection. Thirdly, inflationary superstring multiverses require fine-tuning! Exclamation marks. This cannot be overemphasized. Robin Collins, Max Andrews, and Luke Barnes continually emphasize this because you need a particular kind of multiverse. Collins uses the analogy of a bread maker and how that needs fine-tuning to create bread correctly, showing lots of fine-tuned aspects. One calculation from Sean Carroll is that inflation occurs in 1 in 10 to the 66 million cosmological histories. That's incomprehensibly small. It's what Luke Barnes calls a cane-toed solution. You simply push the fine-tuned bump in the rug elsewhere back to inflation. Well, of course, you wouldn't have known when you sent this in that Luke was coming on the program today, and indeed Max. But I hope you enjoyed their contribution there, Josh. You also go on to say, Phil's also incorrect that string theory isn't necessary to ensure variation. Suppose that all universes contain embodied agents. Why suppose that the brute fact of the multiverse is that it falls into the life-permitting range? Why shouldn't they all be dead instead? Indeed, this seems incomprehensibly more plausible. If so, string theory doesn't contain anywhere near the experimental confirmation. Indeed, it's the much more widely disparaged aspect of the multiverse as untestable, and the like Penrose called it a collection of hopes on Unbelievable. It's more necessary fine-tuning, which requires explanation. And fourthly, don't listen to scientists who tell you to leave it to the scientists. Very frustrating comment from Jeff. The philosophers might just have something to say. Indeed, the simplicity, coherence, and comprehensiveness of God as an explanation far beats an inflationary superstring multiverse, which also fails to explain the origin of protein folds, the Cambrian explosion, moral obligations, moral knowledge, rationality in general, the origin of language, the scientific discoverability of the universe, and so on. Okay. Well, Jeff got back, actually, to say he wasn't in any way meaning to say when in the comment you referenced there in number four that we should leave science to the scientists. I think he just meant if you want to join in, anyone can get on board that train, and so on. But here's what Phil had to say in response to Josh's email. Hi, Justin. Thanks again for having me back on the show and giving me a chance to respond to Josh. Boltzmann brains is something we discussed with Alan Guth in our film, and he stated that calculating whether these dominate is no easy task, and so no one really knows whether Boltzmann observers should outnumber normal observers. It's also possible that Boltzmann brains actually can't form, and there are a number of different proposals that argue for that. Bill Craig, in his debate with Sean Carroll, objected to some of these approaches, claiming they need a non-standard measure of probability. Well, Don Page, a well-respected Christian evangelical cosmologist, wrote an open letter to Bill Craig stating, "Dear Bill, you referred to using some non-standard probabilities as if there is just one standard, but there isn't. As Sean noted, there are models which give high probabilities for Boltzmann brain observations, which I think count strongly against such models, and other models giving low probabilities for them." He went on to say the problem doesn't give evidence against a multiverse. In any case, it also seems to be a problem that needs to be dealt with even in just single universe models. Does inflation need fine-tuning? Again, to quote Christian cosmologist Don Page, probabilities depend on the theory or model. So without a definite model, one cannot claim that the probability for some feature like fine-tuning is small. In our film on loop quantum cosmology, the scientists claimed inflation needs no fine-tuning in their framework. We have seen similar claims in other quantum gravity proposals. Inflation may not be the whole story, but that doesn't mean it's wrong or that God has to step in. Alan Guth in our film claims that a low probability for inflation is utterly irrelevant as it makes an infinite amount of space. Clearly, there are different views on this in the community, and very few think it's a fatal problem. I urge caution in quoting one or two papers and thinking they represent factual discoveries or even the views of the community. And Josh complained about Jeff's comment about letting the scientists sort it out. I suspect Jeff was hinting at the amazing success scientists have had in detecting things many thought would be impossible to find. Think of the chemical composition of the stars or gravity waves. Recently, a number of more interesting experimental probes for the multiverse have been advanced. Anthony Aguirre in our film discusses some of these more direct probes. Alex Valenkin and Alan Guth are also working on seeing if they can predict properties in black holes from eternal inflation. Again, that's discussed in the film. Steven Weinberg already predicted the dark energy on the basis of the multiverse reasoning. Perhaps most importantly, George F. Stathiou, the cosmologist who presented the Planck satellite results at the European Space Agency press conference, stated their data implies inflation happened and that inflation is eternal. He said this was the most important result from Planck. Some cosmologists have argued inflation might not be eternal, and this result clearly speaks to that. Even the critics of inflation, like Paul Steinhardt, agree Planck's favoured model of inflation are eternal and do lead to a multiverse. I suspect that's why Jeff and other theists are reconsidering their position. Anyway, thank you very much. It's an interesting debate. It has begun, and other people have stepped in as well. Just a couple of minutes left to get some of your responses again to Derren Brown. I had an interview split over two shows with him. He, of course, a mentalist, illusionist, well-known here in the UK. Talking about his atheism, we had some interesting discussions on the resurrection, and, of course, his major stage show, which came to an end recently, Miracle, in which he appears to be able to recreate the effects of a sort of healing rally. He's actually got a new book out on happiness now, which I've been seeing a lot of in the media. But here's what a few people had to say, again, on the back of that interview. Sam Blair got in touch via Facebook to say, I really enjoyed the series with Derren. I'm a hospice chaplain and once had a couple on service who were both very involved in a faith healing group. Well, she had a stroke several years prior. She was terminal, but the husband always affirmed that she would be healed, even as she lay dying. When she did die, he was completely broken. Faith healers do more than just con people. They hurt them psychologically, emotionally, and spiritually. Now, I don't know whether that means, Sam, you don't believe full stop in healing, or just that they had a bad theology of healing or something. But this from Graham, who says, well done on the excellent interviews with Derren Brown. On a few occasions, you characterise the naturalistic worldview as being just molecules in motion. I concede many people espouse a naive, eliminative, scientistic physicalism of fundamental particles having intrinsic properties. Such a view possibly is describable by the caricature of just molecules in the void. But such people aren't paying attention to current science. They need to understand that this fundamental particles view is just a working model, suitable for some purposes and explanations. A more reasonable naturalist needs to be willing either to suspend judgment on the most fundamental nature of reality or be willing to engage with a metaphysics that takes our best understanding of science seriously. One such view is ontic structural realism. And on this view, the ideas of objects with intrinsic properties or just molecules in motion are completely rejected. I guess you've pushed one of my buttons. I find that when Christians drag out this caricature, I feel that those people really haven't tried very hard to avoid strawmanning the naturalistic worldview. Perhaps something to return to at some point. It sounds complex, Graham, but I'm sure we could get our heads around it. Ontic structural realism. Daniel Hendricks says, when I lived in the UK, I spent a great deal learning magic from Pete Turner, who has a similar mentalism background as Derren Brown. I went to several magic shows and training sessions where I met many magicians, mentalists, and I'll simply say that in almost every case, they did have atheistic leanings. Of course, I almost always tended towards an apologetic on code-based magic and compare that to the schemes and codes and how to interpret them and how that directly compares to biological code. In every debate, the evidence is generally avoided and the focus is back on how Christians falsely exploit believers, as Derren seems to believe people are sheeple. I'd love to have had a chance to debate him myself and also show him my favourite card trick. Be blessed as usual. Thank you very much, Daniel, and all those who've been in touch about these recent shows. Great to hear from you. Hope you can come back for another interesting programme at the same time next week. You're unbelievable. I'm going to be joined by two historians of the ancient world, Tom Holland, who's written many popular books on ancient Roman empires and the like, and also Larry Hurtado, whose new book, Destroyer of the Gods, talks about the unique place of Christianity in the first century. They're going to be talking about the impact of Christianity and why Tom Holland changed his mind on the way it has influenced Western culture. Hope you can join me for that at the same time next week. Until then, have a great week.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.